From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Amid the general atmosphere of political gridlock and economic dread, the Pew Research Project for Excellence in Journalism studied the media coverage of the current crop of presidential contenders and found, sit down, that the president's coverage is overwhelmingly negative. And by overwhelming, I mean that when looking at 11,500 news outlets over the previous 5 months, Pew found that Obama's negative coverage outstripped the positive by nearly 4-1. Mark Jerkowitz is the associate director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
How do you measure positive and negative press? Because you're talking about news coverage as much as editorial and opinion.
Yes, we are. And this is kind of a new research tool for us. It was a computer algorithm developed by a company called Crimson Hexagon. And we actually used our own human researchers and coders to train the computer, basically, to look for positive, negative, and neutral assertions. Our sample was over 11,000 different media outlets.
So how do you account for this overwhelmingly negative coverage of the president? This was like 9% positive versus what?
34%
negative. Yeah.
When we first looked at the numbers, Brooke, it surprised us too. But then when you start to actually understand sort of the structure of the coverage, it makes more sense. And here's what we found. We're talking about 7, 8, 9 Republican candidates out there now in the news every single day. They're debating frequently. And all of them, to one degree or another, are constantly critical of the president. That gets baked into what people see, hear, and read. So you first got this multiple chorus of people who want the president's job. Then you're going to have clear tensions that we have between the administration and the Republicans on Capitol Hill. You also, frankly, had plenty of Democrats who voiced displeasure with the president, either the results or the tactics, so he had problems within his own party. And then there's one other huge element. The biggest single story in this five-month period that we were looking at is the United States economy. It filled about one-fifth of all the coverage we looked at. By and large, the economic story has been an unrelentingly negative one in those months. And those stories, which are linking the president to a bad economy, put all those things together and you get this almost 4-1 ratio.
All right. But there's also the part of it that there isn't a whole lot of coverage, for instance, of the things that the president has done to try to relieve the economy, wouldn't you say?
Well, he's out there making the case that, you know, he's done certain things. He staved off what could have been a depression, all that kind of stuff. And those things would be positive assertions about him. But they're almost always part of a broader story that takes a look at, well, what is the state of the economy, or then has people who are critical of the president for the economy. So it's a harder case to make that things could have been worse than they are. And it's not something that's frequently a dominant issue in the media narrative. One of the oddest things we found, and this may be illustrative of the problem the president has in the media, we actually began this survey on May 2nd. That's one day after the killing of Osama bin Laden. We actually expected, at least from the week of May 2nd through May 8th, that the president would have a positive narrative. Well, as it turns out, he didn't. He still had a negative narrative. And the story said things like, Americans, disgruntled by a bad economy, soured by rampant partisanship in Washington and uncertain about their own economic prospects, cheered the killing of Osama bin Laden last night. So even in those kind of stories, you're going to have these negative connotations that arise.
So let's pivot to the GOP candidates. Their coverage has been, relative to the president, very, very good. Part of the reason, obviously, is that there aren't any policies they have to own at this point, right? This is all horse race coverage. So if you're up, you get positive coverage. And if you're down, you get negative coverage.
That's very true. They don't own anything. The president's being judged by everything that's happening in the United States these days. These folks are being judged on a much narrower scale, which is how are they competing against their own rivals?
You mentioned the word narrative, and I know some people complain that the word is used too much when applied to the news media, but I think it's really important. I feel like I'm getting hammered with the same story, different face, every other week, which we saw with Bachman, and we saw with Perry, and now we're seeing with Herman Cain, and they're up, then they're way, way up, and then they're down.
The dynamic of this race has been really interesting in that in the key Republicans we've seen, their trajectories have all been bumpy. and not smooth at all, with one exception, Mitt Romney. So I'll start with him for just a second. The tone of Romney's coverage remains sort of mixed week in and week out, doesn't change very much. I think it reflects two things. Number one, he does well in a lot of the horse race indices. His fundraising is very good. He's at or near the top of the polls usually, and that generates positive coverage. On the other hand, the one element of the storyline that he's unable to escape is the consistent suspicions that he has real problems ideologically, maybe even theologically, with some of the Republican base.
Let us, for the sake of argument, say that these polls have any meaning. Do the polls drive the coverage? Did the coverage drive the polls? None of the above.
Maybe all of the above. That's the better answer. D. We did look at it for the period of time that we're studying, and it varied widely. For example, Michelle Bachmann's poll numbers actually jumped well ahead of the improvement in the tone of her coverage, which could suggest some skepticism about her on the part of the media. In the case of Herman Cain, however, his positive coverage preceded by weeks, frankly, his ascension in the polls. And then again, you look at Mitt Romney, it looks like the tone of his narrative remains sort of impervious to his status in the race. Because when Rick Perry got in August and zoomed ahead of Romney, you would think intuitively, okay, his narrative is going to go down. It didn't. It stayed mixed.
So you're saying that's our story and we're sticking to it?
Yes, for now anyway.
One last question. What about the media's liberal bias?
We look at the numbers. We don't try and deduce what the motivations might be for journalists. We could tell people what we found, which is if there was some idea that perhaps the media is in the tank to Barack Obama, then obviously his numbers would belie that. If there would have been some expectation that the media, being part of the establishment, would probably have been more receptive to a traditional establishment Republican candidate, Romney's coverage does not suggest that, particularly when measured against the coverage of Perry or Bachmann, conservative candidates aligned closely with the Tea Party. So I would say, based on what we've seen right now, there are some myths that probably could be put to rest.
From what I'm seeing right now, the mainstream media are Tea Partiers.
No, that is what the mainstream media are doing right now. They are deep in the horse race phase of a campaign. They are looking at it through this frame. Here is a competition. We're not judging the candidates on their ideology, even on their readiness to be president, whatever the case. They're in the first leg of the race. There's seven or eight of them on the track. Who's winning? That's driving the coverage at this point.
Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke. Good to be with you.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. For a historical perspective on the numbers, we turn to Robert Lichter, Director of the Center for Media and Public Affairs at George Mason University. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
You have data on the same time frame as the Pew study for the previous three presidents. Are the numbers negative?
All three presidents who were going to run for re-election the next year had pretty negative press in that preseason period. George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton all had roughly 2-to-1 margins of bad press to good press coming up toward the primary period of election year.
2-to-1 is bad, but not as bad as Obama's 4-to-1. But we need to keep in mind that your methodology was entirely different from Pew's. For instance, you left out anything that had to do with the horse race. How come?
Information about the horse race is kind of a prediction. But when we talk about good press or bad press, we're talking about evaluations of whether a candidate is valuable, not just whether he's politically viable. Any time a candidate breaks out of the pack and does well in the polls, he or she is going to get a lot of good press. And of course, that's happened one at a time to some of the Republican candidates. It's also true that candidate Obama has gotten a lot of good press for all the money he's raising, for his campaign organization. So viewed as a presidential candidate, I think he would come out better than viewed as a president overall.
Now, your sample size is limited only to ABC, NBC, and CBS, whereas the number of news outlets Pew surveyed was orders of magnitude larger.
Nobody has ever looked at remotely as many media outlets as Pew is doing. My hat is off to them. It's still the case that in presidential elections, the broadcast networks are still very important. 4 years ago, what Katie Couric had to say was more important than any of the 11,000 other news outlets that were out there.
But even if we take it out of the election context, and I'm going to point you to another study that your Center for Media and Public Affairs at George Mason University did in 2010, where you measured the three networks' coverage of the presidents in their first 7 months in office. And we're talking about Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and also Obama on Fox. And you found that in those first 7 months, Ronald Reagan got 37% positive, Bill Clinton 34, George W. Bush 37, Barack Obama 35, and Obama on Fox 27.
Presidents used to get a honeymoon when they came into office. That had stopped for the last couple of decades. The first time a new president got a honeymoon in the last 25 years was Barack Obama. He got tremendous coverage as a presidential candidate, which everybody knows. That carried over into his first 100 days. But after that, he started getting treated like any other president, which is to say, badly.
The media in general just don't like presidents, do they?
To get balanced press is a triumph for presidents.
Your findings have been frequently cited by groups that have criticized the media for its liberal bias. Do you see one here?
It's hard to say that there's a liberal bias when Barack Obama is getting overwhelmingly negative coverage. Presidents come in with high hopes, and he pushed the hopes higher than most, but then they just become presidents, and they get beat up by the press.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure.
Robert Lichter is the director of the Center for Media and Public Affairs at George Mason University.
Coming up, a report from South Africa where the media are in the middle of political and civil disarray.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
Hello, pod people. It's that time of year, that time when we ask you who may not depend on a local radio station or who just ignore their entreaties to pony up for On the Media's podcast. WNYC covers the cost, and it ain't cheap, and we need you to pitch in. So please text OTM to 25383, and by doing so, you'll be sending $10 to WNYC. The donation will appear on your phone bill. Messaging and data rates apply. We've got a lot planned for this election season, like our political ad-busting take on Mystery Science Theater. We call it Media Scrutiny Theater, where we will be following the money spent by the so-called super PACs. This summer, we launched our website and our blog, which this week features some extras you won't want to miss, including a post about Gaddafi's gruesome death, and also producer Alex Goldman's diary on his road to recovery using a video game called Super Better. Show us, please, that our efforts matter to you by sending us $10 for the podcast. Text OTM to 25383. Seriously, this matters to us. Thank you so much. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here in the United States, the press initially cast a wary eye on the Occupy Wall Street protesters, unsure of their seriousness and staying power. After more than a month, however, the protests have become a bona fide news story. Part of what's lent the protests credibility are seemingly coordinated protests around the world, and the international media have been paying attention. Here's a clip from China's CCTV.
Demonstrators have been camping out for weeks in a park near a street that has become a symbol of capitalism.
And on Al Jazeera English,
has the spirit of the Arab Spring come to Wall Street, or are these just anarchists out to make trouble?
The Atlantic.com contributor Heather Horn has been watching the foreign media coverage of the Occupy Wall Street protests. She says the press over there was quicker than the American media to give the protest serious examination.
while American news sources have been criticized for dismissing the protesters early on, the European press in particular was very, very quick to accord it a certain amount of respect and to treat this as a serious response to the problems of capitalism. You're seeing French papers like Le Monde saying the anti-Wall Street movement reaches Switzerland or takes Switzerland. So they're clearly saying that protests that were scheduled, you know, in Zurich and Geneva and Basel are part of the same movement as Occupy Wall Street. You're also seeing news sources like the Arabic language Al Arabiya calling it Wall Street Spring. That's their headline that they went with.
And the Spanish daily El País?
Well, El País actually mentioned Occupy Wall Street in the same sentence as the riots in Arab countries and in Greece. Implied in mentioning these all on the same sort of list is that they're all sort of the same types of movements.
I was most interested in the quote you cited from Die Welt. They wrote, "Whoever wants to change the world must also be able to entertain. America shows us how it works." What does that mean?
Die Welt ran this article talking about the appearance of the Wall Street protesters. There's some talk about how they're dressed, talking about attractive academics and so forth. Just as you saw relatively early on, some American news sources deriding the protesters for
generating a carnival atmosphere?
Carnival atmosphere is a good way to put it. I mean, you were seeing these various clips of people doing yoga, people beating on drums, and I think that made it relatively easy for some figures in the American media to dismiss this as a random parade of misfits. And you definitely aren't really seeing that in the European papers, and the Die Welt article is a very good example of that.
And what about the Chinese news agency Xinhua?
So you're seeing, in particular, Xinhua's English site running stories that say, oh, well, this is showing how the American dream doesn't really work. What you're also seeing is that Xinhua has really caught on to a meme in American media saying that American journalists haven't covered this very well. Some of the Xinhua writers are saying that American journalists are turning a blind eye to popular discontent in their own country.
Generally, reporters are a bit skeptical when it comes to street protests. They want to see some proof that they're going to hang around. The Chinese have protests practically every week.
They do have a lot of protests. And certainly as American readers looking at this Chinese viewpoint that Xinhua has put forth, it can look a little bit opportunist, right?
just a little.
Obviously, from the Chinese perspective, if the American free press is really just in the pocket of the establishment, then the Chinese state-run media is no big deal.
How about on Al Jazeera Arabic?
Al Jazeera Arabic also covered the fact that American media was coming under fire for not covering this as well as perhaps they might have. The interesting little trend here to note is that Al Jazeera Arabic and Al Jazeera English were very highly praised in the States, including by Secretary Clinton, for covering the Arab Spring really well. So there has been this meme over the past couple months that Al Jazeera is really good at covering mass protests where American media perhaps aren't.
Is there any in-depth discussion of the issues, or are they, like the American press, waiting for them to get specific?
There definitely is an in-depth discussion of the issues. One German language paper, Die Zeit, gave American intellectuals, as they call them, 6 pages to sort of discuss the possible revolution in America. So that was a relatively in-depth treatment, and from a foreign paper at that.
What do you think is the starkest contrast, then, between the foreign press and the American coverage?
What's really fascinating about the Occupy Wall Street story is how much it really is proving a sort of Rorschach test for these various national presses. This readiness to see it as an anti-capitalist response in France and Germany, this readiness to see it as a problem with America in the Chinese state-run media, and in fact, a signal of the press not being as free as Americans like to say it is.
All right, Heather, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heather Horn is a contributor to TheAtlantic.com. Occupy Wall Street has yet to change the way we distribute wealth in this country, but it's already changed the way we think about the word occupy.
The Occupy traffic people have not got there yet, have
not
they?
Yet. No, they
the
haven't.
Pips is going to occupy the whole thing. They're just going to come there and occupy the whole night.
Occupy golf course?
We should also occupy Sesame
they're
Street.
They're going to occupy their humanity.
Ben Zimmer is executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com and former on-language columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's been tracking the shifting meaning and usage of occupy. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
So you refer to the talismanic power of the word, not in a political sense, but a linguistic one.
That's right. It is this extremely useful word for the movement because as it spread to other cities, it can very easily just work as a kind of a template. Occupy blank. Occupy the name of your town here.
It's also changed in how it's used.
Occupy is an old word. It's been in the English language since the 14th century. It's almost always been used as a transitive verb. That's a verb that takes an object. So you occupy a place or a space. But then it became used as a rallying cry without an object, just to mean to take part in what are now called the Occupy protests. It's being used as a modifier, Occupy protest, Occupy movement. So it's this very flexible word now that's filling many grammatical slots in the language.
Have you tracked the way that the word has been played for laughs? After a long day of protesting, sometimes folks talk about how it's time to occupy my bed. And then there's this from earlier this week in Zuccotti Park. Here's a guy who's using the human microphone to make a statement to his girlfriend.
I brought you down here in front of all these people
to give you something you've deserved for a long time.
To give you something you've deserved for a long time.
So, Deb, will you occupy my life?
Will you occupy my life?
Yes!
Oh, that's cute. I mean, and it's a sign of the way that people are making this word, occupy, their own.
Let's go back to the beginning. You wrote that the earliest evidence in the Oxford English Dictionary for this sense of occupy, to gain access and remain in without authority as a form of protest, derived from 1920 Italian protests.
It's rare that we can pinpoint a new sense of a word so closely, but what we find is that there were these protests happening in Italy, mass protests against factory conditions. So the factory workers occupied the factories, shut them down, and just stayed there for their protest demands to be met. And so it was in the English language coverage of that strike that we get the word occupy and occupation used specifically to refer to protests.
You've got military occupations in Haiti. You've got the Soviet occupation of much of the Eastern Bloc. Didn't the protesters consider that it might be dangerous to use a word that's been aligned with imperialism?
It's true. It is charged with many political meanings. But because it is so flexible, it can take on different meanings and it can be used in so many different contexts. Those are all marks of the success of a linguistic pattern because it's so endlessly adaptable.
I'll say, because if you scroll down, I mean way down the Oxford English Dictionary definition of occupy, and you get to the eighth one, it's a transitive verb that means to have sexual intercourse or relations with.
That's right. That's part of the checkered past of the word occupy. Back in the 17th or 18th century, you wouldn't want to use that word because it had this naughty meaning to it. That meaning faded away and the old meanings came back, and so it's not seen as this taboo word anymore. But it just goes to show how one single word can encompass so much in its history.
You have a lot of different hats, one of which is being in charge of the American Dialect Society?
Well, just in charge of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society. It's a scholarly group, and one of the things that we do is we select a word of the year every year. So, for instance, last year we selected app, APP. The year before that was another techie word, tweet. And I think that Occupy is coming on strong as a definite front runner, and we'll see by the end of the year if it really shows that staying power, as I think it will.
What's the competition?
Remember when Charlie Sheen was a big deal and everyone was talking about winning? Back in that brief moment at the beginning of 2011, we might have thought that winning would be a winning word. It could be something related to the economy. One word that has come up quite a bit is downgrade. The U.S. debt rating was downgraded by Standard & Poor's. And when that happened, that idea of downgrading sort of took off as a kind of a metaphorical idea of what's happened to our country.
You guys are so fickle. Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Zimmer is executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com.
In this week's Economist, an article headlined "A Can of Worms" began thusly: yet another South African chief of police and at least two ministers look set to bite the dust in the latest swirl of corruption scandals to hit President Jacob Zuma's government. A couple of weeks ago, the ugly headlines concerned the government's denial of a visa to the Dalai Lama, who wished to join Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the cleric's 80th birthday. The ruling ANC party, however, feared for offending its trading partner, China, and snubbed the exiled Tibetan, sending the venerated Tutu into a rage.
This government is worse than the apartheid government, because at least you were expecting it with the apartheid government.
Meanwhile, you can't open a newspaper or turn on a radio in South Africa without being confronted by ANC Youth League boss Julius Malema, a militant populist espousing nationalization of the mining industry and marginalization of the white minority still disproportionately wielding the nation's economic power. This in the starkest of terms. Here he is berating a BBC reporter for being an agent of white oppression.
Don't come here with that white tendency of undermining blacks even where you work.
That's rubbish.
And you can go.
And here is Malema singing the struggle song "Shoot the Boer," which translates as "Shoot the White Farmer."
Shoot to kill.
17 years after the largely peaceful overthrow of apartheid rule, South Africa and its ruling ANC seem to be at a crossroads. One path leads to the gradual evolution of capitalist democracy, messy and checkered but guided by constitutional law. The other leads to political chaos or worse. The chaos is already encroaching, as the corrupted Jacob Zuma administration struggles to deliver jobs, education, and even the most basic services to its poorest citizens. The worse looms in the presence of Julius Malema, whose rhetoric evokes eerie echoes of Robert Mugabe and the Zimbabwe liberation that itself, more or less 17 years later, began mutating into a brutal racist dictatorship. Last week, as Western broadcast hosts are wont to do, I parachuted into South Africa for a glimpse. But first, I spoke with a reporter who has covered the country for years. Andrew Meldrum is Global Post's deputy managing editor and regional editor for Africa.
Since the end of apartheid, the ANC government has taken a generally pro-business economic policy. The big business of South Africa, mining in particular, they have been able to carry on with business as usual, and they've done very well. However, the ordinary black South African worker has not benefited very much. Employment hasn't grown, and their housing is still very bad. The services they get, the education they get, have not improved. In fact, by many measures, their standard of living is actually eroded since the days of apartheid. This is where a demagogue can come in and start to point fingers and blame whites or blame others, and it can get ugly.
And there is such a demagogue on the horizon right now.
There is a demagogue, Julius Malema, who is a young firebrand. He's not from the anti-apartheid struggle. He's too young. He is one of those who's picking up the banner and singing very inflammatory songs.
His vision is very much a Mugabe vision of confiscation of agricultural land from white farmers and redistribution of wealth, not necessarily in a democratic fashion.
It's not just confiscation of farms. He's also talking about nationalization of South Africa's mines. It's gold. It's diamonds. It's the largest employer, and it's a major producer of wealth. And to say that these would become nationalized and taken out of the hands of private, mostly white owners is very inflammatory.
Hugo Chavez, and then some.
And then some. We could even say Fidel Castro or Robert Mugabe. I mean, you know, it would put him in the league of those.
And what is the medium for the rhetoric, for nationalization, for confiscation, for furthering the class struggle?
It is at rallies. It is in song. It is in posters that are carried on the street. It is in the unions that are marching to protest low wages, or the South African Communist Party, which is a major ally of the ANC government. It is in discussions that you hear on radio talk shows. It's all pervasive. You hear it in different ways all the time.
It's clear that under BOTA, the South African Broadcast Corporation was entirely under the thumb of the apartheid government. Is it equally true under the ANC and its and the series of presidents that the SABC is cowed by the ruling regime?
No, it's not equally true. However, the ANC government has recently resubmitted a bill to parliament that many say is akin to old apartheid laws on secrecy. And so there still is a danger of very strong state control.
Okay, so you are a government broadcast channel that is the most important voice in news for a large, diverse country. And you are facing populist dissatisfaction, entrenched ownership interests, which are the backbone of the economy, chiefly white, and a president with both a heroic past and a checkered past who is nominally a socialist but wishes for the economy to function. What kind of line do you toe when you're the SABC News?
It's had to shift because, first of all, there was the kind of golden era of freedom for all when Nelson Mandela was president, and there wasn't strong control of what the line should be, and there was just a big switchover from the old apartheid voices to the new liberation voices. But once Thabo Mbeki became president, he started trying to control very strongly the line that the SABC would put out. Jacob Zuma has a new group of people that he has appointed into the SABC at executive positions, but it's still widely seen as the government mouthpiece.
Andrew, as always, thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Meldrum is the deputy managing editor and Africa editor for Global Post.
Coming up, Bob goes inside the South African Broadcasting Company and also coping with what may be South Africa's coming storm.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For an analysis of the press environment in the 17 years since the end of apartheid rule in South Africa, it would be hard to be any more succinct than Jeremy Maggs, news host and media analyst for the independent broadcaster E! News.
It's gritty, it's rugged, it's determined, and it gets up the nose of everybody.
Chief among those irritated noses is the ruling African National Congress Party, which has dominated government since the 1994 end of the great anti-apartheid struggle. Once upon a time, ANC leaders were the unequivocal good guys, liberators of a nation, and authors of perhaps the most inclusive, individually empowering constitution ever written. Now they are the authors of breathtaking corruption, political infighting, scandalous failure to deliver basic services to the poorest citizens, increasingly brutal responses to civil protests, and a growing intolerance for criticism. Maggs and the rest of the South African media establishment see a gathering storm of press intimidation via proposals for a new secrecy law and the formation of a media appeals tribunal as a government arbiter of press excess.
this revolutionary party, now a ruling party, increasingly finds itself on the wrong side of the masses whose interests they claim to promote.
That's Jimmy Matthews, head of TV news at the South African Broadcasting Company, or SABC, which controls 3 of 4 national channels.
The contradiction is that the ruling party, the ANC, is responsible to a large degree for delivering this constitution that we have. And so one would expect that they would be the champions to defend this, but in reality they are politicians.
That allegation of political opportunism has long since ceased being controversial. Whether the episode was former President Thabo Mbeki's AIDS denialism, or his coddling of Zimbabwe dictator Robert Mugabe, or current kickback scandals totaling in the hundreds of millions of dollars, the ANC has repeatedly appeared, in a word, un-Mandela-like. What is controversial, however, is the SABC's standing as a critic of politics as usual.
SABC Radio and Television, we always take their stories with a pinch of salt.
Joe Twole is South Africa's press ombudsman.
Sadly, the SABC, which in fact should be the crown of journalism in this country, isn't doing what it should be doing.
The proposed press laws, Twole says, whether passed or not, invite self-censorship in what he sees as precisely the SABC model. He's not alone in that view. William Byrd, director of the public interest group Media Monitoring Africa, says the organization is weighted down with hundreds of political appointees, called cadres, whose sole qualification is service to the ANC.
I've spoken to producers who've said that ministers phoned them and said, we want this person on air, where the pressure is as direct as that. But there's a perceived implication that they would want us to do this, so we'll make sure that we follow that line.
Or, Byrd says, made-to-order coverage for people in high places wishing to grind an axe on SABC. When the respected Mail and Guardian newspaper questioned a government contract let to an oligarch named Robert Gumede, the SABC quickly ran a 2.5-minute story consisting mainly of Gumede's wild, never-substantiated accusations, including bribery and racism, against the newspaper reporter. Here's how it sounded on SABC.
He alleges the Mail and Guardian newsman Sam Soul was paid by Stellenbosch to write the damaging stories about him.
Here's a payment made out to a so-called investigative journalist who goes out to attack black people to say that they are corrupt, they bribe people.
Gumede says he's being vilified by the paper because of his public support for the ANC and a suspicion that as a black man, he must have acquired his wealth dubiously.
Response from the Mail and Guardian was presented as an 8-second perfunctory denial.
This news is brought to you by
SABC.
In its earliest post-apartheid days, the SABC was the aggressive, courageous, muckraking news organization it had never been under minority white rule. But this critical source of news, information, and entertainment for South Africa's population of nearly 50 million has gradually drifted away from the public broadcasting role mandated in its charter.
Because the new governors could not let go of the power that they saw that the previous government, that the apartheid government had over the public broadcaster, which is a very powerful medium.
Mondli Makanya is group editor-in-chief of the newspaper group Avusa and chairperson of the South Africa Editors Forum.
So you can imagine the temptation. You can imagine how they salivate at the ability to do that. So they soon turned the public broadcaster back into the state broadcaster, something that actually is a pale shadow of what we all hoped it would be.
All this criticism, Jimmy Matthews, head of news at SABC TV, has heard many times before.
SABC is everyone's favorite whipping boy, and, you know, that comes with the turf. There seems also to me to be a notion, and I think it's a cheap notion, that to be independent, you have to be critical of government at all costs.
No, you have to be willing to be critical of government at all costs.
And that I agree with. And I think that we have been And I don't think that the SABC is often given credit for that.
He cites, for instance, the April police killing of a protester in the town of Vicksburg in the Free State, an episode the SABC happened to be on hand to record and which it broadcast, most graphically, the same evening.
It started as a peaceful march, but there was little doubt that many residents were angry. They were demanding action from a municipality they say have constantly ignored their calls to deliver. The resulting scuffle was both brutal and shocking.
Though the authorities were shaken by such reporting, and let that be known to Matthew's superiors, he says it's not necessarily explicit interference that makes his job difficult.
And I have a newsroom filled with poorly trained reporters where there is no real incentive to go out and break stories. I find a newsroom that is subjected to the demands of the trade unions where the first recourse to criticism is to call the union rep. That the place is littered with party hacks is without dispute.
Recently, a mid-level editor suggested covering a run-of-the-mill ANC press conference.
I said, unless you can actually tell me what this press conference is about. Yes, we will attend the press conference if we think it's important and it would be a part of a bigger story. But the press conference on its own does not qualify. I'd hardly got to my desk when my phone rang. And it was an ANC person calling, saying, oh, I believe you don't cover our press conferences anymore.
Matthew says he struggles daily to navigate the many political, budgetary, commercial, and personnel obstacles in his path because he believes SABC can and must do better.
I've been shot at. I've been slapped about by the apartheid police. Had cell doors slammed shut behind me. I do what I do voluntarily. I'm not a member of a political organization. I think even those critical of the work I do, if they criticize the journalism, that's fine. I have a very clear view of what journalism I will try to leave behind. And every day is a struggle. I haven't had a single easy day.
To this lament, however, at least one ex-SABCer is unimpressed.
What marginal benefit is there if your two choices are a genuine propagandist versus a Jeremy Matthews who is basically a human being walking around with a vision in his head, but there's nothing that the millions of viewers see when they tune into the telly.
Eusebius McKeyser was an outspoken and confrontational host of the SABC political interview show Interface when he bluntly challenged the Minister of Justice.
It took just a couple of phone calls from one of the minister's team who were unhappy at the grilling that I had given him, the Minister of Justice. And then the sort of soft technique to get one out of the building started kicking in.
He can't prove that stepping on powerful toes ended his SABC career, but he believes it was the precipitating event for a series of decisions that he says ultimately compelled his resignation. Jeremy Maggs, the media critic at competing E! News, can't speak to the particulars of that episode, but the story sounds to him, also an ex-SABC host, all too familiar. So, too, the intimidation it implies.
You talk about the gathering storm. I think it's a lot more than that. I think the storm has already arrived. I think it's raining, to be quite honest with you. And I just hope that the umbrellas that we've got are, you know, strong enough to withstand all the drops that are coming our way.
The SABC sits atop a hill in Johannesburg, two circa 1960 office towers connected by a warren of corridors, dark, weary, and institutional. The whole complex looms over the city. As I walked outside into the southern hemisphere spring, clouds literally hovered at the tower's rooftops. At that very moment, a big story was breaking. It involved the secret use of government funds to lease 86 cars, including top-of-the-line Mercedes, in violation of contracting rules. The purchaser? The SABC. In South Africa, where free expression is constitutionally enshrined, some of the most cutting opinion is freely expressed by two men who have battled two regimes in a variety of genders under four names. One of them is billed as South Africa's most famous white woman, the irrepressible Evita Bazaidenhout.
A journalist last week wrote that Jacob Zuma's government was corrupt and inept and was a kleptocracy. So we had to summons him to appear in front of the media tribunal. Of course, he apologized. He said he didn't mean to be libelous. I said, Scotty, you're not libelous. It's just that you disclosed a state secret.
Such an institution is Evita that in her rural hometown of Darling, an hour west of Cape Town, she is honored by a thoroughfare called Evita Bazaidenhout Boulevard. Quite a tribute, considering that, strictly speaking, Evita Bazaidenhout doesn't exist. She is a fictional character, the creation of playwright-performer-satirist Peter Dirk Ace. But when South Africa's foremost comedy transvestite dons the dress and wig and heels, lo and behold, Evita appears. And she is boulevard worthy. Evita is Bill Maher in Dame Edna's clothing, and the Sunday cabaret audiences here in Darling adore her.
Here comes Mrs. Evita Bazaidenhout.
Evita's character became famous in the apartheid period as a hilariously out-of-turn speaking wife of an Afrikaner cabinet minister. Now, after a bizarre personal and political journey as a worker and revolutionary, Evita has a different ruling class to embarrass.
She's no longer the minister's wife. She has, having gone through the kitchens of the ANC, because in 94 she lost her job as the ambassador and she started cooking for reconciliation.
Evita's alter ego, Peter Dirk Ace.
So she's been in the kitchen, she's been their nanny, and she's been the babysitter for hundreds of little Zumazelas. So she comes very much from that point of view, trying to share with the majority of her audience, who are the white people, that they must stop being frightened, because there's nothing really to frighten. One of the lines she says, you must please understand, what I've observed is the ANC will investigate every cul-de-sac before they find the freeway.
He, she, they have come a long way from the P.W. Botha, South Africa, as the performer, his makeup baby-oiled away, almost wistfully recalls.
I had to be on my toes all the time. And doing the show in the mouth of the dragon, I would do a show in the Pretoria Opera House in 1985 with P.W. Botha up the road with the security police waiting for me behind the curtain. That's why I never left the stage. I would change on stage because if I went off stage, they might grab me.
17 years later, the tables have long since turned, but Evita Bazaidenhout has more to ridicule than ever, to Peter Dirk Ace's delight and to his accumulating horror. Jacob Zuma disappoints him, Julius Malema scares the daylights out of him, and the ANC asks to be made fools of every single day.
I am in clover, that's why I don't pay taxes, I pay royalties. Because they really give me so much. The only problem is that it is so third-rate. It is such, they're third-rate people with fourth-rate ideas.
Perhaps, but with first-rate lawyers. Back in Cape Town resides another famous anti-apartheid voice with an assumed name, the political cartoonist Zapiro, who has taken on the ANC and been rewarded with a defamation lawsuit from President Jacob Zuma himself. Two of them, actually. The latest followed Zuma's acquittal on suspicious procedural grounds of major corruption charges. That following Zuma's previous acquittal on rape charges stemming from an encounter with the HIV-positive daughter of the president's close friend. Here is Zapiro, a.k.a. Jonathan Shapiro.
I did a cartoon that was very, very tough. It looks as if he's about to rape Lady Justice.
Unsurprisingly, Zuma and his cronies, who were depicted as holding Lady Justice down, totally flipped out, and a good part of South Africa with them.
The furore around the cartoon was the biggest that's ever happened in South African cartooning. It was our equivalent here, I suppose, of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, furore that happened in Europe and then worldwide. It was huge. He sued me for, what was it, seven million rand.
Not to be confused with the 2006 lawsuit following Zuma's rape prosecution, when Zapiro ridiculed the politician's claim of protecting himself from HIV infection by showering after sex. The cartoon depicted Zuma with a shower head attached to his skull, where it has remained in virtually all of Zapiro Zuma cartoons ever since. That suit was for 15 million South African rand.
Which was a world record for a cartoonist being sued. That was 15 million rand, which is, you know, 2 million US.
Mazel tov on the world record.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The case is set for trial next year, and Shapiro is nervous about it, hinging as it does on the question of dignity, which, like free expression, is guaranteed by the South African Constitution. But he says he's far more concerned by proposed press laws and the chilling effect they would have on bringing to light the massive problems of South African governance and society.
Instead of fixing those problems, instead of admitting quite how bad they are and trying to sort something out, what it appears to be is that they are trying to put a lid on the people who are exposing them. They're putting a lid on the whistleblowers, on the media, on anyone in civil society who's critical. They're trying to paint all those people as counter-revolutionaries, and they're trying to up the idea of dignity so that they can say, well, my dignity has been impinged by that press report. And I think that this is really mounting to the point where I'm not sure exactly, I can't, you know, forecast exactly when it's all going to explode. It's exploding in small, funny enough, there goes the noon gun, just as a graphic example of that.
Oh yeah. As he speaks, as if on cue, the noon cannon fires off of a Cape Town cliff, a centuries-old warning to seafarers of the rocky shoals ahead. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Jody Avergan, with more help from Gianna Palmer. Special thanks to Doug Anderson, who produced the hell out of the South Africa package. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.